I suggested, he said, got any idea what you want to talk about? And I just sort of, without thinking, I spontaneously, I don't know why I said this, how it is, I said, I'll talk a bit about Mahakashyapa and the flower. This is a very famous incident. Within Buddhism, actually it doesn't come from the Pali Canon itself. Kashyapa, quite an important figure in the Pali Canon, but the actual incident that I said I'd talk about, I think it first appears in a flower sutra, a Chinese sutra called the Flower Sutra, that's what it's translated as. I think it was in 1036, is the earliest version known of it. So just before the Battle of Hastings. So it's not really about the Pali Canon, but it is about someone that was featured quite heavily in the Pali Canon. And I'll say a little bit about Kashyapa as he comes down to us from the time of the Buddha. And then I'll try and say a little bit about the particular incident that I was said I'd talk about throughout the Dharma. I sort of instantly regretted it in a way because I can't say. We got the Buddha with a flower up here, haven't we? I mean, the whole story, I'll tell you the punchline before we start, I'll come back to it, but the whole story is that the Buddha holds up a flower and Kashyapa smiles. That's it, you know. But it's not that... it's not that exciting, really, is it, you know? Anyway, and the whole point of it is it's a sort of transmission which cannot be or undercuts rational thought, undercuts. It's often said, beyond words, letters or words outside of the scriptures. So it's a transmission that happens completely outside of a rational, if you like. And so it's rather foolish. Of course, this is something about Zen itself, you know. So Zen actually is all about direct experience. There's hundreds of books. If you ever go to Zen, no, I won't go on about it. You go to Zen talks, and they talk for hours, and then you think, what the hell are they talking about? You have no idea what they're talking about. Anyway, we'll come back to this. First of all, we'll just have a little bit about Kashyapa. There's lots and lots of stories about Kashyapa that come down to us. It's said he was born, a bit later than the Buddha probably, but very much in that time period, in Magadha. And it's said he's born, in some ways this is a familiar story in a way. He's born into a very wealthy family of Brahmin. It's said that his father was richer than the king, a very wealthy family. He's born under a tree, like the Buddha, born under a tree. I don't know the details of it, but his actual given name is something like Pithapa, or something, which means born under a tree. And he grows up a very sort of, what would be the word, unworldly boy. He wasn't really interested in, right from the beginning, he didn't really have any interest in sort of material wealth or fame or these sort of things. But he did have, he's trained, we're told, he was trained in the sort of arts. So he had an artistic bent and he was trained in the arts. And from a very early age, he seems to have decided he wanted to lead a spiritual life. As is familiar in these stories, so it's always interesting, these stories, when you start getting these familiar motifs, you know. And whenever we get, I mean, all these stories are kind of apocryphal. I mean, they no doubt got some. I mean, I'm sure, I don't think there's any doubt he actually existed, just as there's no doubt that the historical Buddha actually existed. But the stories that accrue around them have some historical element to it, but there's also a deeper element in a way than what we might call a mythical or archetypal element. And these elements are kind of universal in that if we think about them enough, they probably have some resonance with our own life. Yeah? And one of the very common elements, both with the Buddha, of course, and with this Kashyapa guy, the guy that becomes Kashyapa, is that his parents didn't want him to become a kind of spiritual wanderer or shramana or whatever it might have been, ascetic. They wanted him to, you know, carry on with in the family tradition. They wanted him to get married. And so when he came of age, they were very keen for him to get married. And we get this rather a story that has resonance with Pygmalion, really. I think I'm right in saying. But anyway, he gets comes out of his cunning plan. He goes to the very, very wealthy, as I said, so he went to the best sculptor in the country, and he says to him, make me a sculpture of the most beautiful woman you can imagine. And so they make this sculpture of this beautiful golden female figure, and he takes it to his parents, and he says, I'll only marry if you can find me one, a woman as beautiful as this, you know. So his parents, they don't know what to do really, so they talk to a Brahmin, and he says, oh, well, what are you going to do is that, I don't know why they've got these details in these stories, but it says you've got to take this statue around every village, every town, and tell the women that if they make offerings to the statue, it would be very auspicious, and find a woman as beautiful as the statue. And we're told they carry the statue from village to village under big umbrella, maybe it was raining. Anyway, of course, they can't find a woman as beautiful as a statue until he crosses. They actually have to cross the Ganges into a different country, to a different city, and then some woman, Subhadri, is talked into going to see this statue by her friends, and this woman outshines this statue. Yeah. So anyway, the parents are all very pleased. The parents of Subhadri are delighted because they know they've heard of this Kashyapa's family, because they're so immensely wealthy. And anyway, cut a long story short, they sort of agree that they're going to get married. Kashyapa doesn't really want to get married, but he also doesn't want to disappoint his parents. Yeah. And anyway, then after the wedding, they're left alone, and they just sit apart in the bridal chamber, you know. And after a while, Kashyapa says to her, oh, you know, what's wrong? And she says, well, really, I'm not interested in the passions. I want to live a holy life. I want to live a spiritual life. So, of course, Kashyapa was very pleased about this, because he's not interested either. And so they sort of make this pretense of being together. And after a while, the parents find out that they're sleeping in separate beds, so they take one of the beds. It's interesting what happened in school, isn't it? But anyway, takes one of the beds, and then Kashyapa says, oh, you know, we'll take turns in sleeping. Anyway. we're fast forward 12 years, yeah. In 12 years' time, the Kashyapa's parents have died. They're still living together. And there's two quite interesting occurrences, which again somewhat echo the life of the Buddha, because first of all, I don't know how this works, so don't ask me, but in the course of Subhadra having sesame seed oil made, you get all these worms in the sesame seed, and she hears her servants saying, oh, at some point there's going to be this terrible retribution for all these creatures that have been killed. Quite, as I said, I don't know the technicality of production of the oil, but anyway, so there's water. And she then immediately gets very upset and tells them to stop making the oil. And on the same day, we're told, Kashyap is out on his estate, and he's still very wealthy, and he's watching someone ploughing. And this is probably most of it will recognise this from the life story of the Buddha. Watching someone ploughing, and he's watching the plough go through the earth, and all the worms being turned up, and all the birds eating the worms. And he's sort of struck, he as well is struck by the suffering of life, you know, he's struck by it. And so he resolves to go off. So he goes off to live the holy life, and he promises Subhadra that once he's found a teacher, tries to have her, she'll come back and tell her, and she'll go off. Anyway, he does eventually, not straight away, he finds the Buddha. That's quite an interesting little story about him finding the Buddha. He goes to where the Buddha's teaching, someone sends him to where the Buddha's teaching, and he listens to him teaching the bamboo grove, and then goes off. And he's left them behind, he's left the Buddha behind, he's walking along, and then he sees the Buddha sitting under a tree. And he's quite mystified by this, because he thinks, well, I left the Buddha back there, and now he's here. Not explained. And anyway, he prostrates to the Buddha, and the Buddha says to him, oh, I've heard many stories of you, and I knew one day you'd come, you know. And so he becomes, and Kashyapa is just delighted, you know, and he becomes this disciple of the Buddha. He's quite an interesting character, this Kashyapa, because he's quite an ascetic. At the time of the Buddha, there seemed to have been certain optional, this is how it's put, certain sort of optional rules for, that the followers could take on. And he very strictly adheres to all these kind of optional extra rules. And we get quite a strong, if you just see the list, you know, maybe it doesn't make much impression on one, but if one actually starts thinking about what it must have been like, we get quite a vivid impression of what some of these guys were like, you know, because some of the rules are, one is that they live outdoors all of the time, you know, so they just live in the open all of the time, you know. They're only allowed three robes, all of which must be made from rags. You know. They meditate and spend most of their time in carnal grounds, in the burial grounds, meditating. And they only eat alms food. You know. They only eat food that's given to them. And they eat any food that's given to them. Any food that's given to them, they eat it. And so, and there's various others, but you get this impression that they were living a pretty rugged sort of life. And we're told at this point, anyway, that Kashyapa, he didn't really like taking part in kind of religious ceremonies, or he was a bit, he seems to come across as a bit of a sort of lone wolf, really, a very serious practitioner, very serious about his meditation, very serious about his ethical conduct and this sort of thing, but not really particularly interested in socialising or being part of a religious ceremony or this or that. There's one very famous story where he goes to see, I'm not really clear why, he goes to see different versions of his story. I'll tell you the most gruesome version, because it's, you know, why not? He goes to see this very, very poor old woman, and she is like really dirt poor. We're told the only thing she has to eat is the water that the rice is boiled in, cooked in. She's just got the left, you know, that leftover water you get when you boil rice that is given to her by other people in the village. She's old, she's very decrepit, she's also leprous. And Kashyapa goes to see him, and they have this dialogue where she says she wants to give him alms, you know. And Kashyapa is very impressed, because this woman's got absolutely nothing at all, but she's still got the desire to honour the Buddha's disciples and give him alms. And of course, the only thing she can give him is this awful sort of ricey water. And in one version, so she pours it into his bowl, and there's a fly in it. And she's trying to get the fly out, and her finger drops off. Not funny. The finger drops out into the water. You know. It's pretty grim, you know. And we're told that Kashyapa sits down by a tree next to him and eats it. You know, eats it. And she dies very shortly after, but because of her generosity, she's reborn in one of the heavens and becomes a beautiful deva. And actually, later was visits Kashyapa and bestows him with heaps of flowers or something like that. Anyway, so we've got all these stories. So we start getting this impression of Kashyapa as quite a sort of singular, interesting character, living this quite very basic life. And there's this time when the Buddha sends for Kashyapa, and Buddha's in this story teaching in a hall, and Kashyapa comes in, and the Buddha gestures for him to sit by his side, and Kashyapa says, "Oh no, I'm not worthy to sit by your side. You know, I've got, anyway." The Buddha gets in and sits down, and sort of praises Kashyapa in front of the assembly. How, you know, devout is, and so on. But then says to Kashyapa, you can stop practicing the sort of optional austerities. And Kashyapa says to him something like, "Well, unlike some of your other disciples, Sariputra and Moggallana, unlike these people, I'm not a great teacher. I'm not a great communicator of the Dharma. I'm not a teacher in the way they are. And so this is my way. This is my way to express my faith and devotion to the Dharma. And that it's through this example that I spread the Dharma. I help to build the Sangha." And the Buddha, so this is, some of you have been on you know, on the weekend of the retreat, weren't you, where you were talking about the four means of unification, you know, and of course this is one of them, this exemplification, you know. And the Buddha then says, well, very good, Kashyapa, that's fantastic, you carry on, you know, in the game, you know, holds him in great esteem in front of the assembly. And I thought this was a rather interesting story, because I've often had the feeling of how important it is. You know, I quite like communicating, I quite like teaching, you know. But I've often had the feeling how important it is having some people just getting on with it, just getting on with really serious practice, you know. And it's always been comfort, I don't know, maybe an inspiration to me that there are these people that are just getting on with meditating, just getting on with practicing, with a study or meditation or whatever. And just doing it, you know, just doing it. And I do think actually this is a really important part of the Sangha, that you do have people like this. And they're not perhaps very visible, but actually I think in some way that I don't fully understand, I think they have a very strong effect. I think they do deepen and strengthen the general body of the Sangha for what they do. So anyway, there's a few sort of stories about Kashyapa, and I'll get on to the main thing, which I better keep an eye on the time, and I know what time, what is the time? I know what time's like, eh?
Coming up to 9.
Okay, we're fine. Okay, but anyway, I think some of these stories, in a way, give us a bit of an impression of what Kashyapa might have been like. It maybe give us a clue why so many hundreds of years later, the Zen tradition, or to be more accurate, the Chan tradition, which became the Zen tradition when it went to Japan, alighted on Kashyapa. I said, you probably don't remember, I said before the meditation that he was the first patriarch of, I got that a bit wrong, of course the historical Buddha was the first, but he was the first point where it was transmitted, he was the first person to receive what late is sometimes these days called transmission in the Zen tradition. And this is very essential to this tradition. You can't really be a teacher in Zen without receiving this transmission from your master. So the incident that this refers to is the holding up of the flower. And in the Flower Sutra, it paints this picture of the Buddha with a little group of his disciples. And he's in the forest next to this pond. And they're used to the Buddha in the afternoons, in the cool of the afternoons maybe, or in the early evening or whenever. They'll gather together and the Buddha would deliver some discourse, you know, on meditation or on some aspect of Buddhist teaching, to deliver a talk. And they were used to him doing this, so they've all gathered round, and Kashyapa's there. And they've all gathered round, and instead of saying anything, this time the Buddha is next to a pond, and he pulls out a lotus, and some of them give this description of this lotus being, the roots of this lotus, and with all this mud dripping off it. You know? Which might or might not be significant. And he holds up this lotus. Is that the right hand? Anyway, he holds up the lotus. And in turn to all of his disciples, presumably it wasn't a very big group that day, and they all think they need to answer this, you know, that he's posing some kind of riddle, he's posing some kind of question, and they all kind of attempt to explain I don't know, the significance of the lotus or what the Buddha's trying to say. And when he gets to Kashyapa just smiles. So this is the story. And the Buddha, something happens between the Buddha and Kashyapa. So this idea of a transmission is this idea of something occurring outside of normal communication, normal rational linguistic communication. I don't think there's anything much one can say about it, but I think what one can remember about it are those occasions that I think they're probably for most of us all too rare, those occasions when we're with someone who is really present and we are also really present. And there's a kind of electricity that goes between us. There's a kind of heightened sense of reality simply because you're brought into presence, you're brought into this, what the Tibetans might say, sort of Vajra presence by this other person and you being so present at the same time. This is, seems to be what has happened. This seems to be what goes on. In a way, it's not, I think it would be misunderstanding to say it's the cause of the any enlightenment. Kashyapa is enlightened, we're told. He is enlightened. But we're not told, well, my reading of it, we're not told that he's enlightened by this experience. What we're told is that he's witnessed, in a way, it's a witnessing of the Buddha of Kashyapa's attainment. When Kashyapa smiles, when the Buddha shows him this flower, some kind of electricity passes between them, and the Buddha affirms, he then goes on to affirm it to the other people, he affirms Kashyapa's attainment. And when I was thinking about this, of course, this has in a way got echoes in the Buddha's own enlightenment story. He hasn't got another human being to affirm his enlightenment, but when, as I'm sure you know, when in the under the Bodhi tree, when he gains insight, he gains enlightenment, he's challenged by this figure Mara, isn't he? He's challenged by this figure, and part of this process is when he touches the earth and he calls the earth to witness, and the earth goddess, or multiples of the earth goddess, rise up from the earth and witness him. So there's something in this about needing to be witnessed. And of course, even in our own movement, even in our Triratna, this is the essential part of the ordination, really. Of course, what's being witnessed isn't of the same level of what was witnessed under the Bodhi tree for the Buddha, or what was witnessed by the Buddha to Kashyapa. But it is a witnessing of something having occurred in that person. And it's a witnessing by someone who's also had, if not exactly the same experience, a similar experience. And this is, seems to be what's happening with the Buddha and Kashyapa. The Buddha knows what's happened, where Kashyapa's got with his practice. And because he's got to the same place, he can witness him. He recognises it, yeah? So I think this is probably the meaning of it. Of course, we can speculate about all sorts of symbolism of the flower and stuff, but maybe the actual object, maybe it isn't a coincidence that it's a flower. Of course, the flower, the lotus in the Buddhism, of course, stands for this opening, this unfolding, particularly the opening of the mind, heart, we should say. It stands for this unfolding, and when I was thinking about this, I was reminded of something in the Platonic tradition, Plotinus, who talks about beauty. So this is this idea of beauty plays a very important part in Western thought, maybe also in Buddhism, but somehow, according to Plotinus, beauty is when something follows its natural way, yeah. Or so, beauty is is when something is fully itself, yeah. When something is fully itself, and contrast, he talks about ugliness being when something deviates from its authentic way or self, yeah? When it loses its grounding, it loses its soul, yeah? It loses a sense of its purpose in the world, why we've come into this world, if you like. From a Buddhist point of view, we've all come into this world to fully unfold who we are. We sometimes, of course, you can talk about this in different ways, but actually, I think the most, when you start looking into all spiritual traditions, I think have this in common. Somewhere in these spiritual traditions is this idea that what you're trying to achieve through your spiritual practice is already, in a sense, present. It's usually present in the heart as a physical organ quite often. It's understood as somehow being in the heart. It's more or less like the heart has a sort of hologram of the universe in it. In the heart, we carry our destiny, we carry what we can potentially become, is in the heart. And what needs to happen is an unfolding of that. In some traditions, the heart carries the universal, and the mind carries the individual. And what needs to happen is some kind of relationship of those two, yeah, that we realize ourselves fully by also realizing the universal nature of ourselves, though this universal nature is in a sense particular to us. It's also got some, well, I suppose if you put it into a Buddhist language, it conforms with reality. So Buddhism often talks about seeing reality as it really is, but we shouldn't take this seeing too literally. Somehow, when we use the metaphor of seeing, it's got this, it's got the danger of somehow placing us as at a distance from what is seen. So the visual metaphor has its uses, but it also has its drawbacks. And one of its drawbacks is that it tends to put things outside of us. Yeah, it tends to create this subtle implication of a distance. Yeah. So when we think about the heart, we don't immediately go to the metaphor of seeing, I don't think. Yeah? We perhaps go to a metaphor that's more to do with inhabiting, more to do with a kind of intimacy with reality. Yeah, I mean, it would be quite different if we said the rather than expressing it as seeing reality as it really is, we could express it as being intimate with reality, being intimate with reality, and that reality exists as much in us, as much in our authentic nature, as it exists in anything else, yeah? And somehow this intimacy with our own heart opens into a kind of universal knowledge or universal wisdom of how things really are. Because we are also how things really are. So it's a kind of more embodied way of perhaps imagining what we're trying to do, rather than trying to achieve some wonderful intellectual penetration. We're just trying to relax into what's really there in us, but not in us as some kind of psychological or purely psychological being, but us as a sort of hologram of reality itself, a part of reality itself. So I wonder if this is what happens between the Buddha and Kāshyapa. There's some kind of presence. There's two people being utterly present to one another, and there's the Buddha witnessing Kāshyapa's attainment. He can see it, and this perhaps puts a kind of seal on it. It's perhaps a necessary for most. He does at one point say, actually, interesting enough about Kāshyapa to his disciples. This is when he's praising Kāshyapa to his other disciples. He said Kāshyapa would become a Pratika Buddha even if he hadn't met me. Yeah. So he recognises that actually Kāshyapa was very exceptional. He would have got somewhere even if he hadn't met the Buddha. Yeah. But having met him, he becomes a full Buddha in a way. Because, to end the story of Kāshyapa, though he's quite a lone wolf, as it were, and doesn't particularly, he just wants to get on with his practice in the graveyard, in the carnal ground. Just wants to get on with things. When the Buddha dies, he's away somewhere else. He's not with the Buddha. He's in the story. It's a rather strange little story here. Now, he spends 7 days getting to where he hears about the Buddha. The Buddha's died. He obviously wants to go and pay his respects. And he takes 7 days to get to where the Buddha is laying in state, as it were. And it says, he came and the Buddha's feet were stretched out from the coffin. I don't know quite what they mean. I don't know they put them in coffins like we do. But anyway, and when Kāshyapa made obeisance to the Buddha, when he bowed down to the Buddha, his feet went back into the coffin and he achieved Parinirvana. The Buddha went off to his Parinirvana, as it were. And anyway, so the interesting thing is that although Kāshyapa has been a bit of a solitary figure most of the time, he takes over because he's been recognized, the Buddha's recognized him as an exemplary and very attained disciple. He's actually the one that takes over from the Buddha. By this time, Moggallana and Sariputra, his two foremost disciples in the past, they've gone, they're no longer there. And he actually takes over with Ananda, actually, later, as the head of the order. So this is quite, and I wonder if this is perhaps one of the reasons the Zen people really liked old Kāshyapa, because it's quite there's quite a deeply held sort of what's the word, it's not idea, but an image, this idea, image, this way of thinking about practice in the Zen tradition is that you do go off, you do your work, you get an attainment, and then they put it very beautifully, they say you return to the city, or you return to the town, you return to community with bliss bestowing hands. Yeah. So you come back, and of course, even though Kashyapa might have ideally liked to continue leading the Mortuary life, he takes on, he steps into his responsibility for the good of the Sangha, and it's him who actually chairs, sort of thing, convenes and chairs the first great assembly after the Buddha's death, where they sort of start this process of codifying and solidifying and carrying on the work of Shakyamuni Buddha. And then so many years later, let's say in the 11th century, the Zen people wanting to trace their heritage back to the historical Buddha, choose Kashyapa as the first link in his lineage. It still continues today if you want to see it in that sort of way. But as I say, it's still the case in Zen Buddhism, as though maybe it's become a bit of a formality in some cases, of this idea that there is a transmission that goes on. I had a very... I've had a sort of little experience of this in a way. When I lived in America, we used to hire this Zen center up in the Santa Cruz Mountains, and it was run by a guy called Colburn. Colburn was brought over by Suzuki, Shinra Suzuki, to help him. Suzuki, of course, became very famous through his Zen Mind, Beginner of the Mind book, probably why he's most famous. Anyway, he brought him over from Japan to help him, and after a while, Colburn went off and started his own thing. And one of the places he set up was this place called Jikoji, where we used to go. He didn't used to be there very much. He was very rarely there because he had another place in Switzerland and another place in New Mexico. But I was leading a retreat out there one day, and we were all in the zendo. It had a very beautiful zendo, because it was very hilly. And the zendo was on stilts, it was kind of in the trees, and it was a very beautiful, it was still there, it was there this summer actually. Anyway, I was leading this retreat, and I came out of the zendo first, you know, rang the bell, everybody else was still in the zendo, and I was walking up to the main sort of dining area, across this bit of grass there, sort of, not really long, anyway. And I saw this little Japanese guy. Diminutive little Japanese guy, and you walk up to each other and you sort of just bow to each other, and he said Colburn, and I said Paramananda, and he said, that's a beautiful name, and that was it. And I didn't think anything of it, you know, and this is I don't know, 20 years ago, probably 20 years ago, I don't know. And very great shame, Colburn, this guy, he drowned not that long after in Switzerland trying to save one of his children. But anyway, so it was very tragic, and he's still sort of revered at those little shrines and stuff. But it's funny, over the years, that little thing that seemed, you know, didn't have any particular significance for me at the time, that little thing that happened, it keeps coming back to me. And it's become quite an important, thing for me. And I think there was something went on there. I don't know what went on, but something went on, you know, where there was this meeting, you know, we were sort of totally open to each other. It was a very sort of special meeting. So maybe just a little taste of this idea personally. And I'm sure, actually, if you think about your lives, maybe whenever, as I say, whenever you are really present with yourself and with another person there present too, there is this little transmission that goes on. And it does say something to you about the nature of reality. Because for that little instant, you recognise somebody else as fully as real as you, and they recognise you as fully real as them, if you see what I mean. There's a kind of recognition that does justice to how things really are, where so much of the time we're so sort of caught up in our own psychology, our own ego, whatever words, our own small self, whatever words we want to use. We're so caught up in our own self, we don't really notice how things really are. Yeah? And there's a kind of beauty, there's a kind of electricity, but there's also a kind of beauty in those little moments. They can happen with animals as well, they can happen with other natural objects, it doesn't have to be human beings. This sort of transmission where reality sort of, we let reality in a way that we're usually quite protective of ourselves. We don't really quite want to let reality in. And in the case of the Buddha and Kashyapa, they both got to the point where reality just flowed through them freely. Yeah? They no longer had any resistance to how things really were. And they could sort of see that in each other. And so that was why Kashyapa had his little smile. And that's it.